Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading True West Magazine, the July-August 2022 edition. Hickok's Twist of Fate by Jeff Broom. Wild Bill's 1870 drunken brawl with Custer's troopers is as legendary as the man of many names he killed. On July 17, 1870, Wild Bill Hickok had one whale of a brawl in Tommy Drum's saloon in Hays City, Kansas. What makes this fight arguably Hickok's most important is that he killed a trooper in Custer's 7th Cavalry, who had earlier been awarded the coveted Congressional Medal of Honor. The truth of the brawl and cavalrymen involved has only recently surfaced from military records in the National Archives. Biographers of Hickok injected so much fiction in recounting this brawl that the truth seemed forever lost. James W. Buell's Heroes of the Plains, 1885, produced a narrative wrong in every detail, including saying the fight occurred in Patty Welch's saloon. Buell claimed Wild Bill's widow gave him Hickok's diary, and thus the brawl is straight from Hickok. It started on February 12, 1870, as a fist fight in the street with the 7th Cavalry Sergeant, but as Hickok was winning, 15 soldiers joined the fracas, pummeling Hickok until Patty handed Hickok his pistols. Hickok then killed several soldiers and was wounded seven times and escaped across Smoky Hill River, 11 miles distant. Later biographers followed Buell with certain emendations until William Connolly changed it to a different February date and said the brawl was caused by George Custer's drunk younger brother, Tom. A greater fiction could not be told. Connolly's notes on his book, housed in the Denver Public Library, cite the source as a letter written in 1926 by a man who was not even born when Thomas Custer was alive. Eugene Cunningham also used his story in his popular book, Trigonometry, A Gallery of Gunfighters, 1934, and now the mighty legend became fact. It is all bunk. Uncovering the Truth, Ryan's Report. Joseph Rosa's 1974, They Called Him Wild Bill, gathered the first facts. Using military records, Rosa identified just two cavalrymen involved in the brawl, John Kyle and Jerry Lonergan. It happened on July 17, 1870, and not in the winter. Kyle was mortally wounded and died the next morning. Lonergan was wounded and spent weeks recovering in the post hospital. Rosa included an obscure Eastern newspaper account from 1909 giving the most detailed account of the row. It was written by John Ryan, an enlisted man in the same company as the brawling soldiers, who said Kyle had earlier served in Company M under the name John Kelly, but had deserted in 1867 and shortly before the fight had re-enlisted as John Kyle. When Ryan recognized Kelly, he went to George Custer to get his desertion absolved and transferred back to Company M, as he had re-enlisted in Company 1. Because Kelly, Kyle, had important meritorious papers, as well as a recent honorable discharge as a first sergeant in the 5th Cavalry, Custer approved Kelly Kyle's transfer back to Company M. Shortly afterward, he was killed in the saloon fight. Ryan's memoir said something new. At one point in the fight, Lonergan had Hickok pinned to the floor and Kyle took out his revolver, which had been hidden under his shirt, put it against Hickok's head, but it misfired. This allowed Hickok time to shoot his pistol behind him, hitting Kyle in the wrist. A second shot to the stomach mortally wounded the trooper. A third shot struck Lonergan in the knee, and Hickok escaped, knowing soldiers would soon be after him. Ryan's account is supported in the earliest extant documents. One is a diary of a teenage girl visiting relatives posted at Fort Hays that summer. Annie Roberts wrote, "In the middle of the night, we were aroused by a man wanting a priest, Father Swinberg, to go over to the town with him. For God's sake, the two men were shot. He went over. Wild Bill, a celebrated desperado, shot them. One died this morning, July 18th. There were shots fired backwards and forwards across the bridge." Company F Private Winnefield's Scott Harvey also kept a diary. He wrote on July 18th, "Two soldiers were shot last evening in Hays City by Wild Bill Hickok. One died this morning and the other is badly wounded." This confirms what the Rocky Mountain News reported July 20th. Wild Bill shot two soldiers in the 7th Cavalry in Hays City on Sunday night last while drunk. Custer's wife, Libby, wrote of the brawl in Following the Guidon, "With the free hand, the scout drew his pistol from the belt, fired backward without seeing, and his shot, even under these circumstances, was a fatal one." George Custer wrote in Life on the Plains that the victims of Hickok's deadly brawls included one being at the time a member of my command. The earliest book mentioning the brawl was W.E. Webb's 1872 Buffalo Land. He confirmed only two soldiers were involved and said a musket placed against Hickok's forehead misfired, otherwise he would have been killed. These accounts confirm what Ryan wrote, including the claim of a weapon misfiring. Ryan's memoirs are themselves an interesting story. Only a portion of them were published in 1909, and they remained lost until early 2000, when a Custer scholar fortuitously acquired the typed manuscript and published them in 2001 as 10 Years in Custer's Cavalry, a 7th Cavalryman's Memoirs. Ryan served two enlistments under Custer and survived Custer's defeat in 1876. His memory is not distorted by anything anyone else wrote, unlike all other accounts of the brawl surfacing in later Hickok biographies. There is no reason to doubt him saying the brawl happened in Tommy Drum's saloon. That Buell cited Welch's saloon is reason enough to reject it, since every other claim he made about the brawl was unadulterated fiction. Who was John Kyle? Additional records in the National Archives support Ryan's account and give us much more about the soldier killed, John Kyle. When a soldier died, his company commander issued a final statement explaining how the soldier expired. There are two such papers on Kyle. The first, simply that he died July 18th of a gunshot wound in Hays City. It was sent back from department headquarters asking whether Kyle died in the line of duty. Captain Miles Keogh, who died with Custer, commanded Company 1, the company Kyle initially was assigned to, exactly as Ryan reported in his memoirs. Keogh wrote a second statement noting Kyle died in a drunken row in Hays City and not in the line of duty. But more importantly, he noted, Private Kyle, alias Kelly, was originally a deserter of Troop M of this regiment, and on reenlisting was assigned to Troop 1, but attached and doing duty with Troop M at the same time he was killed. This important statement shows that Kyle and Kelly were the same person, just as Ryan had said. Company muster rolls show in 1867, Kelly, who is really John Kyle, and Ryan, both corporals of Company M, together deserted on the same day in June while Custer's men were camped near Fort McPherson in Nebraska during Custer's first Indian campaign. Ryan's memoirs do not mention his desertion. Turning himself in weeks later, Ryan was court-martialed, and in his defense, he stated on the morning of his disappearance, he was filling canteens in a distant stream, but got lost returning to camp due to a dense fog. This was confirmed by his company commander, and Ryan was exonerated. The likely story is that Ryan and Kelly Kyle left camp the night before and visited a nearby hog ranch as Custer camped a few miles from the post the night before the dense fog. This is confirmed by the itinerary journal of Lieutenant Henry Jackson. The fog disoriented the two corporals, and the command left without them. Kelly Kyle went to St. Louis and on July 24th enlisted into the 37th Infantry as John Kyle. His new company was assigned to New Mexico, where his Company C constructed a camp later named Fort Lowell. On Christmas Day, 1867, Kyle was arrested by his first sergeant for being drunk and stealing goods from the sutler's store. He was confined and court-martialed. Found guilty, he was given a dishonorable discharge and ordered to serve 3 years hard labor at the Jefferson City, Missouri Federal Prison. He escaped in June 1868 while being escorted. He went back to Tennessee, where he had earlier served when he first enlisted in the 5th Cavalry on December 9th, 1865, but deserted on November 20th, 1866. He re-enlisted 3 days later as John Kelly and was assigned to the newly formed 7th Cavalry. Now back with the 5th Cavalry, Kyle was court-martialed for desertion and found guilty. He never mentioned his stint in the 7th Cavalry as John Kelly. Sentenced to a year of hard labor, but not discharged. 4 months were erased for voluntarily surrendering. At the conclusion of that, he served under Brevet Major General Eugene A. Carr in the winter campaign of 1868, when Custer's 7th Cavalry had its November 27th victory against Black Kettle's Cheyenne Village on the Washita in present-day Oklahoma, with Ryan participating. Carr's command was soon sent north to Fort McPherson in the spring of 1869 and participated in the Republican River Expedition, sent to punish Dog Soldier warriors who had raided north-central Kansas in late May. That campaign ended in the destruction of Tall Bull's village at Summit Springs on July 11th. 3 days earlier, Kyle, along with two other soldiers sent in search of an abandoned cavalry mount, had a brisk fight with more than a dozen warriors who thought they could easily kill the men caught miles from their command. Instead, several warriors were killed, most wounded, and the men escaped to report Kyle's heroics in saving their lives. He received the Medal of Honor on August 24th, finished his enlistment, and was discharged as a first sergeant May 17th, 1870. His discharge papers noted his excellent character. On June 2nd, he enlisted as John Kyle in the 1st Infantry in New York. His citation for the Medal of Honor misspelled his name as K-Y-L-E, but he deserted the next day and then appeared in Chicago June 9th and enlisted back into the 7th Cavalry as John Kyle, K-I-L-E. He must have recognized an officer in New York who knew of his earlier dishonorable discharge in the 37th Infantry. It is the best explanation for his desertion after only one day. Both the June 2nd Kyle and the June 9th Kyle enlistment papers have written on the back that he ended an earlier enlistment in the Company M, 5th Cavalry. Hence, both Kyle, K-Y-L-E, and Kyle, K-I-L-E, are one and the same. And so, this is the Kyle Kelly persona noted in Keogh's statement after Kyle's death. Further, his 5th Cavalry court-martial confirms his initial enlistment in 1865 as a teenager. Thus, it is the same soldier who had 4 enlistments in 5 years under 3 names, 3 desertions, 2 court-martials, 1 dishonorable discharge, and escaped prison sentence, and one final hell of a fight with Wild Bill Hickok. In an amazing twist of fate, the very day Kyle was shot, 84 new recruits arrived by train. One was Frederick Thies, who was assigned to Company M also. Had Kyle not been killed by Hickok, Thies would have recognized him the next day as the 37th Infantry soldier dishonorably discharged who escaped a 3-year prison sentence. Thies was Kyle's company first sergeant who arrested him on Christmas Day, 1867, and testified against him at his New Mexico court-martial. When Theus's 37th Infantry enlistment expired, he re-enlisted and was sent to the 7th Cavalry. But he never knew the man shot that first night in the 7th Cavalry was the same man court-martialed in his 37th Infantry Company in 1867. And now we know the details of the man killed by Hickok, shot in Tommy Drum's saloon the night of July 17, 1870. Kyle was a brave soldier who unfortunately stumbled across the path of Wild Bill Hickok and lost. Had his pistol not misfired, today we likely would not know a man named Wild Bill. And that is why the July 17, 1870 fight is the most interesting of all of Hickok's gunfights. What happened to Jerry Lonergan? Military papers in the National Archives show Jerry Lonergan was a baker from Cork, Ireland. He enlisted at New York City December 26, 1867, at age 22. He had hazel eyes, brown hair, fair complexion, was 5 feet 9 inches tall. After Hickok wounded him, he remained in the Fort Hays Post Hospital until August 25th. 5 months later, he was arrested and court-martialed for a drunken outburst, which ended his career in the 7th Cavalry. His trial began February 25, 1871. Several soldiers testified. In the early morning hours of February 1st, Lonergan appeared at the bunk of Corporal Zemetzer and tried to arouse him from bed. He kicked at the bed several times and began to curse at Zemetzer. Two soldiers escorted Lonergan to his bunk and told him to go to sleep. Lonergan was intoxicated, loud, and boisterous. Corporal James Byrne said Lonergan threatened that he would shit in the room, barracks, if he had a mind to, and nobody would say a word to him. Things calmed down until shortly before dawn when Lonergan got up, and according to bugler John Murphy, instead of going to the rear, he stopped and done his business in the quarters. When asked what Murphy meant, he replied that Lonergan had made a deposit of man manure on the floor. Upon learning this, Captain Frederick W. Benteen ordered Lonergan arrested. First Sergeant Frederick Theus went to awaken Lonergan and escort him to the guardhouse. This was the same soldier who 3 years earlier arrested John Kyle for a drunken escapade in New Mexico while in the 37th Infantry, and who, after reenlisting in the 7th Cavalry, arrived at Hays on the same day Hickok had his deadly brawl. Theus reported, "Seeing that he wished to make resistance, I put on my belt and pistol and then ordered him to follow me to the guardhouse immediately. Upon that, the prisoner drew a clasp knife from his pocket, opened it, and said, 'If you say another word to me, I'll cut the guts out of you.' I, knowing the disposition of the prisoner, then drew my pistol and thereby probably prevented actual violence on his part." Lonergan called several other soldiers in his defense, who stated he was only slightly intoxicated and denied he was boisterous and loud. The trial lasted 4 days. He was found guilty on all counts, sentenced to the Fort Leavenworth prison for the remainder of his enlistment until December 26, 1872, forfeited all pay, and given a dishonorable discharge. 6 months into his sentence, Lonergan wrote to Secretary of War W.W. Belknap and pleaded for a second chance. He believed his trial was not fair because the officers were already prejudiced against him. He wrote, "I hereby ask for a remission of sentence and to be again restored to duty, if such is possible, having been in the U.S. service since 61 and endured all the hardships of a soldier's life during the late rebellion, suffered the hardships of Southern prison as a prisoner of war for 8 months. Upon being discharged, I again joined the regular army and have served honorably ever since, until the misfortune of being court-martialed befell me. I have no disliking to become a soldier again, having never deserted the army. I feel myself capable of the duty of a soldier in every respect. Lonergan was denied clemency and disappeared from recorded history. If Ryan's memoirs are correct, Lonergan was soon killed in another incident involving an infantryman. But there is an enticing different possibility needing further investigation. Records in 1903 from an old soldier's home has a logbook noting Jeremiah Lonergan, born about 1838, Ireland, entered soldier's home, Bath, New York, 1903. Company E, 12th New York Cavalry, enlisted 9/21/1864, Troy, New York. Two of Kyle's enlistment papers said he was born in Troy. So if this is the same Lonergan, this might be why they gravitated into friendship in 1870. Discharged 6/19/1865, Halifax, North Carolina. Could this be confirmation that Lonergan did serve in the Civil War, as he reported in his appeal to stay in the service? Jeff Broom is a sixth-generation Coloradan. He has published several books on the Indian War, covering 1864 to 69. His newest book is Indian Raids and Massacres: Essays on the Central Plains Indian War, Caxton Press, 2020. A retired philosophy professor, Jeff lives in Beulah, Colorado. True West, July-August 2022 edition. Magnet for Miners by Candy Moulton. A tour of Western Montana is rich in mining heritage, ghost towns, and living history centers. Gold seekers started flooding into Western Montana in 1863, setting off the first rush for riches and the establishment of the town of Bannock, which became the territorial capital of Montana the following year. Almost simultaneously, prospectors found gold in Alder Gulch, and miners quickly rushed there and gave rise to Virginia City, which then became the territorial seat of government in 1865. Today, Bannock is a ghost town, and quite an interesting one at that, where about 50 of the structures from the town's heyday still line the dirt street. It is now Bannock State Park, which is open from Memorial Day to Labor Day, with tours and a variety of activities. Virginia City is a state historic site, and compared with Bannock, is still quite a going concern. Business continues in many of the town's historic structures, and it is an easy stroll from one end of the commercial district to the other. The National Historic Landmark is open year-round with a variety of key activities during the summer, including the Alder Gulch Short Line Railroad operations, and an opportunity to do some gold panning. Pick up some period attire at Rank's Mercantile before you attend the Brewery Follies or have a libation at the Bale of Hay Saloon. On occasion, the city also holds an 1865 Victorian Ball. Just a mile from Virginia City is Nevada City, which has an outstanding collection of 19th century buildings that had been moved from various areas of Montana to create a town that interprets much of the mining and early settlement history in the state. Butte also began as a gold and silver mining camp in the late 1800s, but by the early 1900s, a new mineral was sought, copper. Miners flocked to Butte from around the world, and following them were the people who populated the city, from Cornish families to brothel workers who offered plenty of action in the red light district along Mercury Street. This mining camp exploded in population, and the mineral resources made many men rich beyond their dreams. These copper kings included Marcus Daly, F. August Hines, and William A. Clark. At the World Museum of Mining, see original equipment at the Orphan Girl Mine, and extensive exhibits that give you a chance to see, and in some cases handle, equipment. Dozens of original and replica buildings are part of Hell Roaring Gulch, including a Chinese laundry. Other places to visit include the Copper King Mansion, which was the residence of William Andrews Clark. The 34-room mansion was built from 1884 to 1888 in the Romanesque Revival architectural style. Today, many of the mining-era buildings, homes, and mansions remain in what is undoubtedly a historically significant location in the mining West. To the northwest of Butte, Phillipsburg started in 1866 after discovery of silver and the construction of Hope Mill, Montana's first silver mill. The town is now also known for its sapphires, and you can mine for some of your own while visiting. Visit Granite County Museum to learn more of the mining history in this area. The museum offers information about and directions to the nearby Granite Ghost Town State Park, with its remnants of buildings from the area's heyday as a mining town. Granite Town site was established after Hector Horton found silver in the general area in 1865. The Granite Mine was established in 1872, with operations moved in 1875. It became one of the richest silver mines in the territory, yielding more than $40 million in silver riches during its heyday. The camp is now part of Granite Ghost Town State Park and includes remnants of the Old Miners Union Hall, as well as the Granite Mine Superintendent's House. Montana's territorial capital moved from Bannock to Virginia City in the mid-1860s, but the seat of government moved again in 1875 to Helena, where four gold miners working in Last Chance Gulch found gold on October 30, 1864. The mine in the Helena area ultimately proved to be the second biggest placer gold discovery in Montana. The Last Chance claims produced around $19 million in gold in just 4 years. Just to the northwest, an even richer vein of gold was discovered and developed in the Drumlimon Mine, operated by Irishman Tommy Cruz. That mine spawned the town of Marysville. It took a while for territorial Montanans to decide where they would place their capital, having moved it from Bennett to Virginia City and then to Helena. But when it came time for the territory to become a state, there was no further change. Helena became the state capital. To learn more about this city, take a historic tour, or visit the Montana State Historical Society, which is in its final planning stages for a new heritage center. Wide spot in the road. Big Hole National Battlefield. Nez Perce Indians, seeking to remain free, crossed through western Montana in 1877, trying to stay ahead of the federal army led by General Oliver O. Howard, who wanted to force them onto a reservation in Idaho. They traveled south from Lolo Hot Springs through the Bitter Root Valley and into the Big Hole, where they stopped at a campsite they called the Place of the Ground Squirrels. They had recently cut new teepee poles, and the camp was a place to rest from their flight and prepare to the new teepee structures. On the morning of August 9, 1877, their sleep was interrupted by an attack of soldiers commanded by Colonel John Gibbon. While warriors counterattacked and held off the army, the women, children, and elders of the tribe organized, and under the direction of Chief Joseph with Chief Whitebird's assistance, fled south through Big Hole Valley. While camped at the Big Hole, Joseph wore traditional clothing, including a waist-length red coat decorated with ermine tails and attached like a fringe to the shoulders and sleeves, and accented with blue beads, brass rivets, and small circles of navy blue material. That coat is now included in the Visitor Center exhibits at the Big Hole National Battlefield. Annually on August 9th, Nez Perce descendants of the embattled tribe return to the site for a commemoration of the battle. True West, July-August edition, 2022. Idaho Trout by Sherry Monahan. Idaho may be synonymous with potatoes, but trout has been a pioneer staple since it was first settled, where cold rivers, streams, and creeks were well known for their abundance of various trout species. Fishermen were known to pull several trout from the cool waters to feed their families or supply local businesses. Newspaper ads and editorials filled papers with trout information as early as the mid-1800s. Idaho attracted tourists and locals alike to fish and hunt, so a need for hotels and lodges rose. The Middle Boise Hotel opened in 1866, and the Idaho World reported, first-class principals during the season and all the delicacies of the country. Trout, grouse, squabs, fresh salmon, etc. are among the choice viands up their bill of fare. A restaurant called Dick's Big Three in Haley, advertised in 1884, grand chicken dinner and fresh brook trout. And the editors noted, the trout have begun to bite ravenously in the lakes. When a trout comes out of his winter quarters and is as lean as a rail and as hungry as a country newspaper man, he will bite anything. Vacationers like Grace Wakerman trekked to Idaho to fish. She was only 13 years old when she fished in Idaho in the fall of 1894. She and her parents left Denver and were accompanied by other travelers as they made their way along clear, cool waters to fish. They camped on Little Blackfoot River, where she pulled a large salmon trout that weighed about 2.5 pounds. She recalled, "I was a proud girl and thought I had done well for one of my age. The excitement can only be felt by experience." They also camped at Medicine Lodge Creek, about which she stated, "This is a sportsman's paradise, as the stream is literally alive with gamey mountain trout. The water is so clear that one can see the trout sporting up and down the stream, tempting the fishermen to take one from its mountain home. The weather is not as nice as we would wish for outdoor sport, but Papa keeps us supplied with gains and fish. He caught 55 trout in 4 hours. Newtown Hibbs shared his appreciation of natural bounties in Idaho with the Idaho County Free Press in Grangerville in 1895. He enjoyed mountain outings with friends where they camped as they hunted and fished. He reported, "The fishing in Fayette is good as at some seasons of the year. On French Creek, the beautiful brook trout fairly swimmed. They came at the flies at every cast in platoons. They were so ravenous that they tore our flies, which were evidently made for us in dry weather, into shreds." Pioneers and visitors alike enjoyed the fish, whether in their homes, tents, cabins, or restaurants. Mr. and Mrs. T.F. Harris offered a massive bill of fare in 1898 at their restaurant in Rocky Bar that included Mackinac, Lake, and Mountain Trout. Priest Lake was a popular spot for trout fishing, and by 1902, the Hotel Clockman was opened and operated by Williams and Downey in Coulon on the water's edge. It soon became known as the Northern Hotel. The hotel, plus Camp Sherwood and the Bungalow Cafe, were in full swing by the 1920s and operated by Mrs. Ida Handy. She offered cottages, cabins, rooms, camping, and boats, and advertised, "Cutthroat trout fishing was never better," in 1929. It's still open today, so you can experience history. There's also the Teton Valley Lodge in Driggs, which has a historical connection going back 100 years. Recipe: baked Idaho trout. 1 whole 1-pound trout, scaled. Salt and pepper to taste. Paprika as you like. 1 14-and-a-half-ounce can tomatoes. 4 onions sliced thin. 4 green peppers sliced. 1 cup olive oil. Wipe the inside and outside of the fish to dry it, and place it in an oven-safe dish. Cut a few quarter-inch-deep slices across the skin to expose the meat. Sprinkle with the salt, pepper, and paprika to your liking. Combine all other ingredients in a bowl and pour over fish and baste occasionally. Bake at 350 degrees for about an hour or until fish flakes apart. Recipe adapted from the Idaho Daily Statesman, March 9, 1908. True West Magazine Archives, July 1989 edition. On the Trail of the Barefoot Outlaws by Lonnie R. Spear. The Barber brothers were professional horse thieves who operated in eastern Iowa and northern Illinois during the 1880s. They remained quite successful until they began committing murder as a sideline. Then, in contrast to the many stories of outlaws who died with their boots on, the Barber brothers found themselves at the end of their rope with no boots at all. Ike and Bill Barber were raised in Fayette County, Iowa. Their family, which included four sisters and an older brother, had moved there from Illinois shortly after Ike's birth in 1855. Their father, Leafy E. Barber, served in Company A of the 38th Iowa Infantry during the Civil War and died soon after returning home in 1865. With his death, Mrs. Barber found herself unable to support the entire family and decided it was necessary to place Ike, who was 10 years old, and Bill, who was 6, in the soldiers' orphans' homes at Cedar Falls. Her oldest son, Zion, she reasoned, was a hard worker and was needed on the farm. But Isaac and William were always getting into something anyway and could adapt to being away from the home much easier than any of the girls. After a few years, Ike and Bill ran away from the orphanage and returned to the farm. By then, they were old enough to help out, so they were allowed to stay. They continued to get into trouble, though, and soon became notorious as thieves. By the age of 23, Ike had married a neighbor girl, Hattie Slaughter. Bill, at 19, married her sister, Alice. The families lived together in the same house, but the men often were separated from their wives for long periods as they became more and more interested in drinking and gambling. In order to support their high times, Ike and Bill began stealing horses. They continued for several years, and although authorities suspected them for their crimes, they were unable to establish guilt beyond doubt. As far as is known, Ike and Bill were the only members of their family to lead a life of crime. That life seemed to go along fairly smoothly until August 20th, 1882. On that date, authorities were directed to the farm of Charles McMahon, 3 miles east of Mount Pulaski, Illinois. McMahon's body and those of his two farmhands, 18-year-old John Carlock and 20-year-old Robert Metheny, were discovered lying face down in the weeds with their heads battered and their throats cut. McMahon, a 46-year-old bachelor, was a wealthy farmer who was well-respected in the community. A neighbor, David Long, found the three bodies gagged and blindfolded, with their hands tied behind their backs, lying near a corn crib nearly 400 yards from the house. The house had been ransacked, and it was believed that $2,000 and a horse had been taken. Two sets of boot prints led away from the area. Local authorities worked on the case for several days, but failed to develop any leads. Farmers in the area organized a vigilante committee and scoured the countryside for suspects. At various times, the committee took several strangers into custody, but for lack of evidence, all were released. Finally, in frustration, officials telegraphed the Pinkerton Agency for help. Meanwhile, back in Iowa, Ike and Bill Barber were carousing among the dance halls and saloons. They attributed the large amounts of money they were spending to having just returned from business in Illinois. By Tuesday night, August 29th, Ike and Bill were conducting business again. They stole three horses from Staples Livery, 5 to 6 miles west of Fayette, and another horse from Brackett's Livery farther down the road. That same night, a buggy was stolen from the Reverend Fothergill's shed, and a harness was taken from the James Niffen barn nearby. This time, though, the Barbers were seen and recognized during the theft of the three horses. By the first week of September, Fayette County Sheriff L.L. Farr had warrants for their arrest. On September 5th, Detective Cleary of the Pinkerton Agency pulled out of the Mount Pulaski investigation in disgust. He announced that the investigation had suffered from blundering mismanagement from its beginning. He said that evidence had been destroyed by large crowds of onlookers the day the bodies were found, and he hinted that the state's attorney had failed to perform his duties faithfully. It looked as though the Barbers would get away with the killings. They were, after all, the first murders they had ever committed. Unfortunately, they wouldn't be the last. About 11 o'clock Wednesday morning, September 7th, Lou Stansberry was returning to his farm near Lima, about 5 miles northeast of Fayette, when he saw the Barber brothers stealing apples in his orchard. Stansberry immediately turned and rode back to where he had seen F. Marion Shepherd and others in a field threshing. Everyone was aware that Sheriff Farr had passed through the area looking for the Barbers the week before, and that he had told Shepherd, a deputy sheriff, to take them into custody as soon as they were seen. Upon hearing Stansberry's news, Shepherd and a friend, Charles Henry, mounted up and rode back with Stansberry, only to find the outlaws gone. Shepherd rode on alone, a half mile farther east, to a railroad camp where workmen were laying rail for the new branch of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul line. Having already arrived at the camp, the Barbers approached the boarding house and asked for a meal. Proprietor E.G. Herrick told them they would be fed after the regular boarders had eaten. With that, Ike and Bill walked out front to wait by their horses. About that time, they saw Shepherd riding toward them. Marion Shepherd was a well-known and popular man in these parts. He was 38, a Civil War veteran, and had served as a constable for a number of years. He was said to have despised the Barber brothers, but had never had a good case against them until now. As Shepherd rode into the area, he recognized the Barbers standing side by side next to the boarding house. He rode up to within talking distance and halted. Casually, he climbed down from his horse and quickly turned toward the brothers with a drawn revolver. "Throw up your arms. You are my prisoners," Shepherd demanded. Undaunted, Ike asked, "We are, eh?" Just as a terrific explosion blew out the front side of his coat pocket and a .22 ball struck Shepherd in the upper chest, Shepherd staggered back and fired a round that grazed the left side of Ike's face. Again, Ike fired his pocket revolver, which he now held out in the open. Shepherd reeled, staggered a few feet, and fell. The Barbers quickly mounted and rode out of sight. Shepherd slowly rose to his feet, staggered several more paces, and fell into some nearby bushes to die. Several railroad workers, witnesses to the shooting, ran to Shepherd's aid, but found they were too late. Messengers were sent to Wadena and Fayette to sound the alarm and to telegraph Sheriff Farr. The next day, the West Union Gazette reported, "Mr. Shepherd was well known in this neighborhood as a law-abiding citizen and a God-fearing man. His loss is a severe one to his wife and 4 children. A subscription fund has been raised for their aid." When word reached Sheriff Farr at the county seat in West Union, he quickly organized a posse. Farmers throughout the region grabbed their guns and eagerly responded until a force of over 100 armed men had been assembled. Upon arriving in the Wadena area, additional men were gathered, and the entire force rode in pursuit of the outlaws. In the ensuing chase, the pursued barely stayed ahead of their pursuers. In fact, it was later learned, the posse several times passed by the outlaws as they hid in the brush. By 3 o'clock Friday morning, the Barbers' horses were badly lathered and had to be abandoned. 5 miles west of Strawberry Point, a widow lady named Morley was awakened by noise in her barn. She looked out just in time to see the Barbers rapidly riding out of her yard with 2 of her best horses. Later that morning, a farmer named Huey was driving along the road when he saw 2 strangers coming toward him. As soon as they saw him, they reined into a turn, got over a fence, and rode hard across a cornfield out of sight. The Barbers continued to ride boldly through the countryside. Near Hazleton in Buchanan County, they came across another farmer in a buggy, forced him to give them a 5-mile ride after they abandoned their horses, then unhitched and took his stallion. When the posse arrived in Hazleton, Sheriff O'Neill of Buchanan County passed his hat around town to buy their supper. By September 12th, the outlaws' trail led back to the Brush Creek area where the shepherd killing had taken place. Briefly sighted, they were corralled in a wooded area 8 miles south of Brush Creek, but escaped by crawling through a nearby cornfield. On September 16th, Iowa Governor Buren R. Sherman issued a proclamation offering an additional $500 reward. Within a few days, though, the posse lost all signs of the outlaws' trail and disbanded. The Barber brothers' flight from justice had lasted nearly 2 weeks and had covered the counties of Fayette, Clayton, and Buchanan before the posse finally had given up. The Barbers fled into Missouri and worked on a railroad crew until they made enough money to continue on to Kansas. There, they worked as farmhands near Clay Center, picking corn. Later, they obtained jobs on a ferry that plied the Republican River. Since the entire Midwest was on the lookout for them, the Barbers decided it was best to move on to Oregon, where they thought they could be beyond the reach of the law. But first, they decided they would go back home and say goodbye to their mother, their families, and several friends. Ike, himself, later reflected on this notion. "Many of the men who hunted us after we shot Shepherd met us and ran away. That's one reason we dared to come back again. We believed the people would fear us." But Ike was wrong. What was more, neither Ike nor Bill would find out until too late that shortly after they had originally fled from Fayette County, their mother sold her house and moved to Glendive, Montana. Such was the case when the Barbers arrived at their mother's old house in West Union, Iowa, Saturday night, June 2nd, 1883. They pounded on the door and awoke the occupants, only to come face to face with strangers. The Barbers fled, but not before they were recognized. The moment they were gone, a hue and cry went up that the Barbers were back, and a posse of 60 armed men was combing the countryside. The Barbers fled west, crossing into Bremer County. They stopped to rest at the Pink Hook Schoolhouse, 1/2 mile east of Summer, and were seen by Daniel Eastman as he was passing by. Eastman rode into Summer and informed Deputy Sheriff Jarvis, who assembled a small posse. Jarvis took Eastman, Alman Tibbetts, M.V. Miller, C.A. Austin, and H.C. Alger as he rode out to investigate. Arriving at the school, they were unable to locate the outlaws. The posse continued to nearby Wilson's Grove and from a distance saw the Barbers washing in a creek. At the same time, the Barbers spotted the posse and ran for their guns and clothing piled on the bank. The posse rode down on the brothers and arrived just as Ike got to his revolver. He ripped a shot off at Jarvis, who was riding in front. The ball slammed into Jarvis's shoulder. Ike ran back toward the creek. Jarvis returned fire as another member of the posse, M.V. Miller, cracked off a round from a Winchester rifle. Both shots missed. The Barbers abandoned the rest of their clothing and quickly waded across the creek through chest-high water. The posse stopped to tend Jarvis's wound while the brothers escaped into the woods. In their haste, the Barber brothers had left their cartridge belts, coats, hats, and boots. From that day on, the people of Northeast Iowa referred to the desperados as the Barefoot Outlaws. By the evening of June 3rd, the posse had the outlaws confined to Wilson's Grove and was waiting for help to arrive. Their efforts were further hampered by a heavy rainstorm. When the storm finally cleared at dawn, a force of 200 men systematically searched the grove, only to find that the fugitives had again escaped, this time by crossing a cornfield during the rain. Word of the Barbers' escape and the fact that they had no boots quickly spread. that evening, June 4th, the brothers found refuge in the Chancey Cook Barn, 2 miles east of Tripoli. While hiding there, they were nearly pitchforked when Cook began pitching hay to his cattle. As soon as possible, they fled west and slept that night in the Samuel Hallett barn. By midnight, though, they were starving, so they walked up to the house and asked Hallett for something to eat. Hallett lit a match, saw their bare feet, and went for his rifle. The barbers ran away. By dawn, the outlaws were 4.5 miles southeast of Tripoli. They ducked into the barn of a German farmer named August Tuckmeyer and remained concealed all day. That evening, June 5th, when Tuckmeyer's son, Henry, entered the barn to milk the cows, the refugees crawled out of the hay and asked for something to eat. Noticing their badly cut and swollen bare feet, the boy suspected they were the outlaws he had heard about. He was also aware of a large reward for their capture, so he invited them into the house and told his mother to fix them a meal. Henry then walked out to another barn, where his father and younger brothers were, and sent them to the neighbors for help. Henry returned to the house to sit with the outlaws. For Henry, the minutes began to pass like hours. Finally, just as the brothers finished their meal, 5 of the area's most stalwart German farmers burst into the room. The barbers jumped up, knocking over their chairs in the process, drew 4 self-cocking revolvers, and began firing. A large German named George Kersting lunged for Bill Barber. With the help of 2 others, he pinned him to the floor and they began grappling for the revolvers. Ike, still firing, backed out the front door. He ran to a window into the room where Bill was being held down. He smashed the glass and fired a shot that struck George Kersting in the back with a mortal wound. Ike had no sooner fired than he was seized from behind by Henry Papa. Wrenching himself away, he turned on Papa and shot him. Wounded in the chest, Papa lunged at Ike again and knocked him to the ground. He held Ike down until Mrs. Tegmeyer retrieved a rope from the barn and helped tie up the villain. Meanwhile, back in the house, Bill had gotten to his feet and began firing randomly around the room. Realizing his son was dead, John Kersting rushed Bill in a fit of rage and was wounded himself. 2 others in the room also received wounds. Old Kersting lunged at Bill again, knocked him to the floor, and held him there until he could be bound with rope. The Germans sent someone to get a doctor and to notify the authorities. The barbers lay on the floor tied up. For the first time since the fight started, they realized the Germans had been unarmed the whole time. Old Kersting checked his son's body again in the hope of finding some sign of life. Finding none, he grabbed one of the outlaws' revolvers lying on the floor, rushed over and shoved the barrel into Ike's ear and threatened to blow his head off. He fumbled with the gun, unable to make it work, and satisfied himself by hitting Ike with the gun several times before throwing it back to the floor. Altogether, it was determined that 16 shots had been fired during the fracas. Sheriff Adair and Deputy Karstensen arrived to take charge of the prisoners. They found George Kersting dead. His father, J.H. Kersting, suffered wounds to his left breast, hip, and arms. Young Henry Tegmeyer had been shot 3 times, the worst being a neck wound, and Henry Papa had a bad chest wound, the bullet having struck a bone and exited at his back. August Turkmeyer's finger, they found, had been bitten so hard it was crushed. Sheriff Adair took the prisoners to the Bremer County seat at Waverly, Iowa, a distance of 20 miles, and locked them up. Word spread about the capture until, by evening, a large, angry crowd had gathered to demand a lynching. The sheriff decided it was best to move the prisoners. After dark, a 2-seated hack was driven up to a woodpile at the side of the jail. The barbers were smuggled into it and driven at full speed to Waterloo, 20 miles distant. There, the brothers were placed on the Illinois Central train to be transported to Independence, Iowa, where they could be locked in a stone jail. John H. Kersting died of his wounds the next day, June 7th. Mobs gathered at Independence, harassing the deputies and demanding justice. The deputies stood firm, and the crowd finally dispersed. By the next day, all danger of mob violence at either location seemed to have passed, so the prisoners were brought back to Waverly. By evening, though, word of their return had spread, and angry mobs began to gather again. This time, a large contingent from West Union arrived, led by Charles Shepard, brother of the deputy killed in the previous fall. They combined with another large mob led by August and Henry Tegmeyer. The vigilantes grew more angry and advanced toward the jail, demanding the keys from the sheriff. He refused and posted deputies around the building. The mob moved off, but within minutes broke into the blacksmith shop and hauled out several crowbars and sledgehammers. Again, they stormed the jail. This time, upon seeing their angry determination in their faces, the guards, along with the sheriff, stood off to the side, out of the way. The mob, numbering 150 to 200 people, included many of the town's prominent church and business people, none of whom wore a mask. They immediately began battering down the front door of the jail. The building contained two cells measuring 12 by 16 feet. The barbers, confined in the north cell, cowered in its darkest corner as the mob began entering the building and began beating on an inner door leading to the cell corridor. After bursting through that second door, they hammered on the cell door, which finally gave way. The mob rushed the barbers, who resisted desperately but were easily overpowered. Ropes went around their necks almost immediately. They were dragged through the building, down the stairs, to the sidewalk, and out into the streets. It is said that upon seeing this, the sheriff exclaimed, "My God, they've got them," and covered his ears with his hands to shut out the racket. People in the crowd began suggesting locations for the hanging. City Marshal John Mack stepped up and told the crowd that if they were bent on hanging the men, they should do it outside the city limits. In the midst of yells of "hang 'em," someone in the crowd, estimated by this time to number nearly 1,000, suggested that the barbers be allowed to talk. The mob became silent to hear their last words. Ike spoke first. He asked for a chew of tobacco. Then he said, "I'm going to tell you the truth. I know I'm going to die in a short time. We're not horse thieves, not murderers. We never killed anyone until last fall, and within the last 2 weeks." "That's enough," someone in the back of the crowd yelled. Ike went on to say they had once robbed a wealthy farmer named Lord in Kane County, Illinois, and ended claiming to know nothing about the Mount Pulaski murders, although they had already confessed them to the sheriff. When it was Bill's turn, he too claimed that he never killed anyone, except maybe last week. He then removed his silk neckerchief and a gold stick pin and handed them to a bystander. He asked that they be given to his daughter. Finally, Bill extended his arm to Charles Shepard, who was standing nearby, and offered to shake hands. Shepard refused. Several bystanders tied the outlaws' hands behind their backs. With ropes still around their necks, the prisoners were led through the dark streets of Waverly and slowly out of town. It was quite dark and nearly midnight when the group arrived at the edge of town. They approached a small grove of basswood trees on land owned by Mike Murphy. By the flickering light of lanterns and an occasional match, they chose the best three trees possible for their purpose. Someone yelled, "Let us pray." With that, everyone removed their hats and bowed their heads. A short prayer was said. Bill was informed that he would go first, so Ike could suffer through watching him. The rope around Bill's neck was thrown over an overhanging limb. He was hoisted up about 5 feet. The rope was tied off, and he was dropped about 4 feet. Struggling very little, Bill slowly strangled to death. Several times he kicked himself away from the tree as his body swayed against it. In 12 minutes, he was dead. In the pale lantern light, Ike watched his brother's form dangle above the crowd. Then he was told it was his turn. The same procedure was followed. While the knot in his brother's rope had flown behind his head, Ike's remained at his right ear. In 3 minutes, he died. Their mission completed, the vigilantes drifted back into town, leaving their victims dangling in the night breeze. The bodies of Ike and Bill Barber swung between heaven and earth for nearly 12 hours. It was noon the next day, June 9, 1883, before Coroner Wilson of Summer and his jury arrived at Murphy's Grove. A crowd of onlookers, many of them women and children, had followed the jury to the site. As the entourage arrived and gazed upon the lifeless forms, they couldn't help but notice, no more than a few inches above the ground, the dangling bare feet caked with clay. History's chapter on the notorious Barber brothers had been brought to an end. The coroner's inquest, though, returned a verdict that the hangings were felonious. It named Charles Shepard as the mob leader, and residents John Legram, Henry Gervick, and Frank Kerr as active participants, together with many other persons to the jurors unknown. The findings of that inquest were presented to the grand jury the following fall, but for whatever reasons, nothing further was done. Court records, in fact, fail to verify that the hangings ever occurred or even that the inquest was held. Consequently, the participants lived out the rest of their lives having to deal with their own consciences for having allowed their emotions to take priority over the law.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.